As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. Today we are reviewing all the biggest talking points from match day 5 in the Champions League. Were Newcastle robbed in Paris? Why can't Manchester United defend in Europe? And what on earth happened to boring Arsenal? Plus, as VAR and refereeing controversy continues to rage, we'll be asking, would fast-tracking ex-professional footballers as referees be a good idea? I'm Gregor Robertson, and joining me to discuss all of that are the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, the football correspondent for The Sunday Times, Johnny Northcroft, and author of the magnificent weekly Times Sports newsletter, James Gearbrandt. Right, to Turkey, where Manchester United defended
Turkeys.
Galatasaray 3, Manchester United 3. It's an absolute classic, I think we'll all agree on that. 33 efforts on goal shared. I think a game where the concept of defending evaporated entirely. United held a two-goal lead twice, but errors from Andre Onana threw Galatasaray lifelines and ultimately left United bottom of Group A, needing to beat Bayern Munich on the final match day and hope for a draw between Copenhagen and Galatasaray. So, their Champions League future is hanging by a very thin thread. Martin.
Yes.
Your column, the headline was a play on a famous Clive Tyldesley line from the 1999 Champions League final. Can they blow it? They always blow it.
Yeah. Well, Clive said famously in 1999, can they score? They always score. And this team is sort of the reverse of the Ferguson team, because whereas Fergie found ways to win, that Manchester United team found ways to win even when they didn't play particularly well, and the Champions League final, the treble winning Champions League final, is a case in point. They weren't great that night at all, but they found a way to win. And Erik ten Hag's United seems to have that sort of reverse Midas touch, where they get into these fantastic positions and they find a way to lose, because I mean they've been ahead now in 4 of their 5 Champions League matches. From that, they have taken one win, which needed Copenhagen to miss a penalty with virtually the last kick of the game, and a draw, which was last night's. And the other two games, when they've been ahead, they've lost. They've scored, we're going through this, they've scored 9 goals away from home. Nobody in the history of English football has ever scored that number of goals away from home and failed to qualify from their Champions League group. At the moment, United are bottom of their Champions League group, having scored 9 goals away from home. If you look at that as an indicator, say just you look at that sort of form as an indicator, right? 9 plus goals away from home in the group stage. There's 6 English clubs that have done it. 2 of them went on to win the Champions League. 2 of them went on to reach the Champions League final. So it's a big indicator of your potential as a football team, being able to score prolifically away from home in the group stage. And somehow United have turned that to bottom of the group. And if there's a result between Galatasaray and Copenhagen, and you think there probably will be if both teams need to go for it, someone will probably get the edge, then they're out. And it doesn't matter. They can beat Bayern Munich 12-0. They're out. If there's a winner in the other game, they're out. It's out of their hands. It's remarkable, because when that draw was made, that looked like a classic 2+2 Champions League group. You get those groups where there's two obvious good teams, two obvious rabbits, and it's just whoever comes out top of those two good teams is who comes first and who comes second. And that's what that group looked like. You went, oh, right, well, that's Man U and Bayern Munich, and the other two will fight out for the Europa League place. And instead, it's been this bum fight. And you can't understand it. You can't. And an Onana's performance sort of sums Manchester United up in Europe, because just when you think, oh, this is going all right now, they look all right now, which is what you've been thinking about Onana for about the last half a dozen matches since he saved the penalty against Copenhagen. You've been thinking, he's turned the corner now. He's growing into this role. The players around him like him, clearly. He's commanding his area. He's doing all the things you wanted him to do. Right, this looks okay. And then he turns in a performance like that, where you could argue he's catastrophically at fault for the second goal, and he's none too he's probably at fault for the first, and he's none too clever for the third, really. So it's remarkable. It's just that case of like turning the corner so many times you end up back where you started.
The Manchester United are the third top scorers in the Champions League, and only Royal Antwerp have conceded more. So that says it all, Johnny. And Onana is a big part of this, isn't he? We have to say that, because while he's been improved in the Premier League, there have been some serious mistakes in the Champions League.
I mean, look, as ever with Man United, you find yourself trying to unravel this huge tangled mess, like literally from week to week, because there's so many factors that go into what we're seeing on the pitch at the moment. And yeah, individuals are part of it, and Onana's performance was kind of mind-blowing in a way. That second free kick, I'm not sure I've ever seen a goalkeeper at that level do something like that. And I've sent my missus, it kind of reminds me of, like, I used to play cricket. I play once a year now, but when
Johnny,
I start...
You're
no, but it's a big game in Aberdeen,
Greg.
Brian
Hardy.
I grew up watching Brian Hardy play for
Essex.
Okay, I could bore you about the Aberdeen grades, but I don't have to mention my average. But when I started getting a bit on the old side and was trying to either field in the slips or the covers, I just found myself, I was always diving after the ball had gone past me, because my reactions had gone and my body positioning was wrong. And I felt very pathetic. And that's looking at Onana last night. I got no idea, from a technical aspect, what he was trying to do, how a goalkeeper who's not old could look so decrepit, getting down late and kind of almost flapping the ball in the net. And that was the second time in the game. So, but, you know, he pulled off some good saves as well. He saved United against Copenhagen. And he's part of this pattern of inconsistency. I'd throw Bruno Fernandes into the mix, who, having scored an absolute belter in the first half, then gives away two ridiculous free kicks. The second one in particular is just a pathetic attempt to challenge someone, and then he sinks to his knees with the.
He looked like he was going to cry.
Yeah, with the kind of hands in prayer. What you know? Why are the gods against me? No, you've tripped someone in a meaningless position, and now they've got a free kick at your dodgy goalie. So there's all of that, but there's a bigger point about United, which is, they're just such an open team. You know, they're just such a badly structured football side. If you're going to play two slow centre-backs, four forwards, a striker that's trying to run through on goal, kind of nothing in midfield. I mean, Scott McTominay wants to join the attackers, and Amrabat's just struggling from an athletic point of view. And then a goalkeeper that wants to kick long. You're going to get a stretched game, because there's no compactness there. There's nothing. None of the parts are fitting together, moving together. The way we saw Newcastle hold out against PSG, where they were compact and they shuffled across together. They worked as a unit. There's none of that with United. And to me, it's a great lesson in never to fall for scoreboard journalism, because after the Everton game, there was a lot of stuff saying, oh, United are back, look at that, 3-0 Everton. Everton had 24 shots and should have been 2-1 up at half-time. United got absolutely goal of, you know, goal of a career from Garnacho to go ahead, the only shot on target in that game, in the first half of that game. And then a penalty, and then they were fine. But that wasn't a convincing reason to say United were back. And then you look at the other wins they've had in this sequence. I was at the Luton game. Were they lucky to win 1-0? Maybe not, but they weren't convincing 1-0 winners. Luton had plenty of the match. They're probably lucky to win 1-0 at Fulham. Fulham had 18 shots in that game. United score in the 93rd minute. So last night, in the Champions League, I think we've seen more, it's like United's underlying faults are all coming out in front of our eyes on these Champions League nights, but they're also there in the Premier League, and we might be in danger of then going back to stuff we've talked about before. But you have to make the point again that this is 18 months into Ten Hag, and we're still seeing something that's hard to kind of recognise from a structure and identity point of view.
Do you agree with that, James?
I do. I think they've taken, if you just in terms of performance, just sort of stripping away the results for a moment, I think just in terms of performance, I actually think they've taken a step back from last season. I think they're worse. Their control of games is worse to my mind. And as Johnny says, I'm just struck by, I'm not a kind of, you know, I'm not by any means sort of a, you know, on the kind of Ten Hag out bandwagon. I would be inclined to give him more time, but I also think you have to say it's very hard to discern, you know, patterns of play, you know, anything where you could sort of really kind of hang your hat on and say, I really see what Erik ten Hag is building. I just don't get that sense. I think one thing also, I mean, clearly they're not a defensively stable team this year, but one thing also I'd point to on this current run, and Johnny kind of slightly touched on it when he was talking about Bruno Fernandes, that they're not an emotionally stable team. They're so up and down. I mean, and you know, the last season when they had that really good run, a lot of it coincided, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, with a period where David De Gea and Rafael Varane and Casemiro were all fitting in the team. And then, you know, you can quibble with the form and the performances of each of those three players. Like, none of those three players, I think, have really excelled for Manchester United. You know, Casemiro's form actually, I think, really fell away quite sharply. I also completely understood the decision to try and, you know, upgrade on De Gea to try and add a new kind of dimension to the team from the goalkeeping position. But I also think that losing those three players who all had a kind of steadiness to them and a sort of steadying effect on the team, I feel that loss is being felt a little bit this season, that they're just, I mean, perhaps it's harsh to sort of to pick on the moment against Copenhagen where, you know, Onana saved that last minute penalty, because of course, you know, you would expect to see a sort of, you know, emotional reaction to that, you know, to a last minute penalty save. But it just feels so up and down at the moment, you know. It feels like sort of wild swings between the highs and lows, and a real lack of kind of stability in all senses, I would say.
If you look at Garnacho last night, if you think of Garnacho in Copenhagen, where Manchester United get another one of those UEFA gifted penalties, like for handball, and they score it, and I think they go 3-2 up at that time, and Garnacho runs over to the Copenhagen fans and puts his hands to his lips, and shh, and you're thinking, mate, there's half hour to go. I really wouldn't have gone there. And next thing you know, they lose 4-3 and they get an equally unjust penalty given against them. Last night, Garnacho scores, fabulous goal, very early on, and goes over and makes a gesture to a stadium that that we've all watched football there, and we all know how nutty it can be at times. And he's telling them to shut up after about 10 minutes. And you're thinking, mate, there's a long way to go. What are you winding them up for? What are you playing that game? Just, you know, and you think back, and you know, and I'm sorry to keep harking back to Ferguson's teams and everything, but they did know how to do it. You know, you wouldn't have seen that from those guys. You know, Roy Keane was a warrior. Mm. But he wasn't a guy to run over to the Galatasaray home support and tell him to shut up after 10 minutes, because he knew there was 80 minutes to go and you all need to keep a bit of a lid on it. Paul Scholes last night was talking about Scott McTominay's performance. You know, there's no better footballer than, you know, there's no comparison. You know, as good as Scott McTominay has been in recent weeks, there's no comparison with Paul Scholes. But Paul Scholes wouldn't have been as gung-ho about last night's performance as Scott McTominay was, despite having the capability to destroy that Galatasaray. There's not a single player that Galatasaray have got that would get in a team ahead of Paul Scholes. No. But he would have kept a lid. They would all have just been a bit more emotionally stable. And, you know, speaking to James's point there, just a little bit more emotionally stable about a game that was very volatile, and that really they sort of had one after 17 minutes. I mean, that stadium was getting quieter and quieter. Yeah. If they'd have just let that drift a little while without Galatasaray getting back into the game, that stadium would have been dead about 10 minutes after half time. It really would. It would have been very, very quiet. We've all seen it out there. It goes nuts and then it goes very quiet if it's not going their way.
I think game management and also time management is a related point, isn't it? You know, I mean, I think back to the Europa League. Was it the Europa League quarterfinal or the semi-final last season where they, I think it was against Sevilla, and in the home leg, they were 2-0 up, I think, and should have been out of sight, really. They were playing so much better than Sevilla, and it was the game where they somehow contrived to let them back in and concede two goals and you know, end up with a 2-2 from the home leg, and obviously then went and got beaten in Seville. I think it was Sevilla, or was it Villarreal? I can't remember.
I think it was Sevilla.
Again, just that game management, knowing where you are in the tie or in the game, and just being able to keep it under control, knowing when to lock it down, and sort of again is a quality that I think they lack.
I suppose the thing that Ten Hag would, you know, look, you can ask as well how much of that is on Ten Hag, but when your goalkeeper's throwing in goals, that changes the momentum, changes the mood of the game, changes the balance of play. So again, it does come back to the kind of chaos of some individuals as well.
It does, but of course he's a Ten Hag recruit, and he probably knew what he was getting, a mercurial goalkeeper who can be incredible, but also isn't as reliable as some others. Anthony, and we've talked about instability as a footballer. I mean, another Ten Hag signing all over the place. Don't know what you're gonna. Well, you actually do know what you're gonna get. He's gonna cut inside, but it's you know, emotionally no control there. I think back to the Luton game I was at. I mean, they were getting counter-attacked by Luton in stoppage time. What's happening? You know, you're 1-0 up at home. Mm. You're on the brink of a much-needed win. You're playing Luton, and I don't know. You're sort of pouring forward and getting, you know, kind of clinging on a little bit in stoppage time.
You do wonder, and I haven't done the research. I am planning to do the research, so I'm not going to labour this point too much. But a pal of mine who in football mentioned to me last night how often, as an Ajax manager, are you 2-0 up against a team that's actually capable of coming back to 3-2 in the Dutch league? You wonder how much experience Erik ten Hag has actually had of being in that position and actually coming up against a team that doesn't think the game's over. Yeah. Because one would imagine against a lot of the teams in that league, if Ajax go 2-0 up, the other team go into damage limitation mode more than, well, let's have a go at this. It's the argument about that time when Spurs were a man down and 3-0 down, yeah, at half time against Inter Milan, and came out and tried to win it. And 4-0 down and a man down against Inter Milan at half time, and came out in the second half and tried to win the game. And you could see that Inter Milan had never in any way considered that the other team weren't going to look at them in the tunnel and go, right, we're not going to hurt each other.
It's,
you know,
it's Istanbul. It's where Liverpool come back in Istanbul. And AC Milan were utterly perplexed as well.
Well, absolutely, because at that point in Italian football, it's like, right, damage limitation, we don't know. And Tottenham came out with one man less and 4-0 down and tried to win the game. And you could tell that Inter Milan didn't know what had hit them. You do wonder, in a similar sort of way with Erik ten Hag, how many times he comes up against a team that thinks 2-0 down is a basis for negotiation, as opposed to as opposed to a moment at which you go, right, well, let's not get beat 6-0 by Ajax, and we'll just batten down the hatches and you know, try not to concede again. I don't know. It's just a thought. I'm going to try and check it out.
Yeah. Well, from a lack of control and discipline by Manchester United, there was a lot of that by Newcastle United in Paris, and yeah, a huge controversy with Kylian Mbappe's penalty late on to deny Newcastle what would have been a gutsy win. The penalty decision, the spot kick was awarded after a VAR review. And the referee going to the pitch side monitor to eventually rule that Tino Livramento had handled the ball inside the box when blocking a cross. The VAR who reviewed this has since been stood down, which is a clear indicator that UEFA feel this was a mistake, and I think that we'll all agree, watching this, we felt the same.
Yeah,
pathetic decision, a ludicrous decision, and you know, travesty for Newcastle given how much they put into the game. I mean that you would have to say that PSG missed about
they did, yeah,
but Barcola missed about five open goals. So in some senses, of course, PSG getting something was fair, but in another, you know, fundamental sense, it was unfair because Newcastle had got to the brink, having heroically held out. And
And with a team that is so decimated by injury and a 17-year-old midfielder.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredible.
Yeah. Brilliant. I mean, it's hard not to kind of draw the contrast, or it's hard to avoid drawing the contrast. But, you know, we're talking about emotionality and so on. Eddie Howe's reaction to that whole thing has been fantastic. He hasn't...
No.
Didn't come out all crying and swinging about the decision. Moving on to the next thing. And trying to, I think, just keep Newcastle where they are, which is in a really good moment. They've got a siege mentality going. They're working so hard in every match. And that's the way to do things. And you just got to take your hat off. I mean, his ability to coach pressing, coach compactness, and engender that sort of group spirit. And we saw it at Bournemouth, and he's managed to do it on a bigger scale. And that was always my doubt, I suppose. I know at Bournemouth, having visited him a couple of times there, that a lot of it was built on enormous effort, individual effort, one-on-ones with players, a lot of culture stuff, putting pictures up in the training ground, the four-foot wheel, all that stuff. And I wonder if you could do that at a bigger place, because it's just more difficult. Mm. But he is. And he's reaping the rewards, and I think it'd be much. I mean, as Martin said, you get some groups that have got a couple of rabbits in them, but then you get Newcastle style groups.
Yeah.
And for them,
could be anything.
You know,
when it started, it could have been anything.
And it still could be.
In three of the teams. Yeah. Absolutely anything.
The headline on following that same theme, the headline on Martin Hardy's piece today is that How comes of age on a night he forgot his own birthday. So this is kind of the first part of that is about, as we say, he said he'd never even been to a Champions League game before this season, not even as a spectator. And the latter bit was an indication that his birthday was the next day, and he's so kind of committed and fiercely devoted to his job that he forgot about it. But Everything Johnny's saying is true, Martin. Eddie Howe looks like he belongs on this stage.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, everything is such a truism or cliche, whatever, a statement of the obvious, but everything is decided by results, because Graham Potter also said he'd never been to a Champions League game, and that then became this stick to beat him with, because the results weren't going well. With Eddie, you know, exactly the same statement, and it's, you know, but look how well he's done, look how well he's adapted. And Eddie's done a fabulous job there, and you know, there's a philosophy there, and it's a hard working philosophy, which is important at Newcastle, because I know Newcastle have had wonderful strikers and great skillful players, and they love that side of it. But it's not a part of the world that, you know, you can get by without working hard as well. Yeah. They want the players to feel as strongly about it as they do, and this is a team that you can say that's true of, that you look at that, and it's a team that reflects the area in a lot of ways. It works hard. And, yeah, they got stiffed. They got absolutely stiffed. The UEFA's interpretation of the handball is just mind-boggling, because there's not a single professional walking the earth that would give that penalty against Livramento. So how have the people deciding on the guidelines for UEFA?
Well, including the referee who wouldn't give it.
Come up with that. The other thing is, I don't understand why they've stood down the VAR, but not the actual referee, because the VAR should come over and have a look at the television monitor. But as was proven at the Bayern Munich game, against Copenhagen last night, just because you go over and have a look at the monitor doesn't mean you've got to give the penalty. Stephanie Fappaya reversed her own decision, basically, whilst looking at the monitor. So something's changed. Something's gone on between Tuesday and Wednesday night. Now, I mean, it's the marquee competition in club football around the world, you know. You can't change the rules of it between Tuesday and Wednesday night. You know, that's a Fred Karno's operation. It really is. I mean, oh, we're playing this set of rules on Tuesday, this set of rules on Wednesday. It's nonsense.
Well, you also can't have a situation. I mean, the whole thing obviously is, you know, it is actually inherently quite comical. But on a serious note, you cannot have a situation where the interpretation of such a fundamental part of the game, the handball law, is different from, you know, from the Premier League to European
UEFA
competition.
Yeah.
Because, you know, obviously we all
the
know...
Premier League aren't outliers, we should say that. It's most domestic leagues.
That's
and
correct.
UEFA.
That is correct, absolutely. As we all know, the handball law affects the way that defenders defend. You know, we've all seen defenders sort of, you know, with their arms kind of tucked behind them. You can't have a situation where a defender is thinking, you know, well, you know, I could sort of, you know, maybe sort of have my arms out a little bit more, you know, in the, it's just, you know.
Also, none of that goes through a defender's head when he simply was turning round.
Yeah. No, of course.
To defend the ball.
But you just cannot, to my mind, you just cannot have a situation where, you know, a defender has got to sort of bear in mind that the game, you know, such a fundamental part of the game is going to be legislated slightly differently depending on what competition they're in. I mean, that to me is just nonsensical. It
does say, without opening up the VAR can of worms too much, but
we'll come to that later, Johnny.
Well, opener
is being prepared.
Here we are. So here it comes. But when you try and make the argument that look, VAR is not working, it's just not working, it's not worth the aggravation, let's just move away, pivot away to something else, you get a big school of thought coming back. VAR is not the problem. It's the individuals. Mm-hmm. It's those referees in the Premier League. No. It's wrong everywhere. See what's happening in Scotland. See what's happening on European nights. There's not the perfect individual out there. That's a whole point.
And this is the referee who refereed the World Cup final.
Yeah, brilliant
Champions
referee.
League final.
Absolutely brilliant referee.
Super Cup final.
But he's not infallible.
He's the best greatest referees in the world, this guy.
So the idea of VAR will be fixed by finding a perfect set of individuals to administer it. Not going to happen.
Well, The thing with that is, I just don't understand how UEFA can play a version of the rules. I always used to think that of English football in many ways, where there were tackles in English football that were waved away, that on the continent would be yellow card offences or fouls or whatever. And I used to write all the time and use this phrase. You know, we're playing a version of the rules in our sport because we like tackles and we like it to be ferocious and stuff like that. And now it's gone full circle, and it's UEFA that play a version of the rules. They play this version where if it touches your hand anywhere, it's a penalty, unless there's a big fuss about it, in which case we've got another version of the rules that we can play the following
night.
The Wednesday version. Yeah, the Wednesday version of the rules when we realise we've messed it up. It's just because supposedly the people that make these decisions, that come up with these guidelines, are professionals. So,
well, UEFA also ignored the UEFA professional body who advise how to interpret the rules. They ignored their advice at the start of I think it was in April.
But there is another point to be made, which is all of the PSG players surrounded the referee screaming for a penalty. At Munich last night, all of the Munich players surrounded the referee screaming for a penalty. Harry Kane and Joshua Kimmich were still going at it after the final whistle. And yet, all of those players, if you fast forward 10 years and put them in a television studio giving opinions on the game, and they'd seen that, they'd go, oh, it's ridiculous if you're going to give that as a penalty. So if that's what you think, what are you surrounding the referee screaming for a penalty for? Yeah. You know, a little bit of consistency where PSG looked to that and just carried on playing, or Bayern Munich looked to that and just carried on playing, instead of wanting this travesty to take place because it was going to be a travesty that benefited them. And we can argue, oh, that's human nature and that's the nature of sport, football or whatever. Yeah. But nonsense as well, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Well, Newcastle's final group game is against AC Milan at St James's Park next month, and as we said, they've still got everything to play for, and that's the group of death. They're still in with a shout and they're going into the final match day. Okay, still loads more to come. If you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you're subscribed. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame for the latest subscription offer.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gregor Robertson. Joining me are James Gearbrandt, Martin Samuel and Johnny Northcroft. To the Emirates next, where Arsenal cruised through to the Champions League last 16 as group winners after a breathtaking first half display which helped them on their way to a 6-0 win against Lens at the Emirates. Six different goal scorers, their entire front five among them. Johnny, what happened to boring Arsenal? That seems to be the narrative in the Premier League this season. They're kind of going under the radar a little bit, despite going top of the league at the weekend. But it looked like they really clicked at the Emirates.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, what we've seen in the Premier League's been, you know, real efficiency from Arsenal without the sort of thrills and spills. And last night was different. But actually, it was also a very efficient performance. It just didn't give Lens a sniff. They were just beautifully oiled. And scored some great goals. The Martinelli goal in particular was fantastic. The front five moved beautifully. Declan Rice, I thought, was fantastic as well. Just the way he was driving forward from midfield, and just it was a one-man sort of transition. It was a joy to watch. I loved the interviewer's question to Mikel Arteta afterwards, where he said, you know, Mikel, was that one of the best halves of football you've had at Arsenal? As if Mikel was supposed to go, oh, well, there was that one we were 8-0 up, and there was another half when we were 10-0 up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're not going to get much better than that in management. And yeah, Arsenal are maybe a bit under the radar because it's not as exciting as last year, but they might be better.
James, you've watched a lot of Arsenal, and you also wrote about Kai Havertz at the weekend, and he's scored a couple of goals since then, which was good timing for you.
Yeah.
what do you make of Arsenal this season? As we're saying, that's the kind of the underlying feeling that they're not quite clicked yet, and despite that, they're top of the Premier League and through as group winners in the Champions League.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard not to be impressed by Arsenal, even though they sort of haven't necessarily kind of, you know, really sort of steamrolled their way through the Premier League campaign thus far. I just think they're a really impressive team. I think, generally speaking, I think defensively they look so, so solid. Like, just, I think even, you know, even more so than they were last season. And I think my impression has been that in the Premier League that's come at sort of a little bit of the at the expense of some of the kind of attacking fluency and obviously also trying to integrate new parts into that attack, obviously Havertz being one of those.
This was probably the vision of what most fans would have thought Arsenal's front five might be before the season started. It's not really happened, but last night, you know, Havertz, Jesus, Saka, Martinelli, Odegaard all scored, all, you know, countless examples of them, those five, pouring forward at pace. So, you know, is that, do you think that's a vision of Arsenal for the future?
I think it could be, yeah. And I think Declan Rice, you know, is such an incredible player in that sort of slightly kind of, you know, hold the fort role. And I think he does just, I think, yeah, an absolutely outstanding player, and this is no slight on him, but I think he interprets that role in perhaps a slightly more conservative way than Thomas Partey did, and I think just gives maybe an element more. I'm not sure you could have played, you know, for example, Odegaard, Partey, Havertz as a midfield three, whereas I think Rice gives you the ability to play Odegaard and Havertz alongside him. I think it's potentially a tremendous front five. You know, I mean, with a little bit more kind of, the fluency that just comes from playing together a little bit more, obviously I know the four players were there last season, but obviously having added Havertz to the mix. I think to sort of, one thing that's interesting that I sort of wrote about at the weekend is Arsenal's games have gone from being sort of among the most, in inverted commas, among the most exciting. Where, if you remember, they had a lot of games last season where, you know, I think
did the most goals per game.
Second most goals per game, yeah. I think, of any 3. Team. For both teams, Arsenal games contained the second most goals of any team. And they're right down this season. This is in the Premier League, so this is obviously the Champions League match. Obviously, there's a slightly different case in point. But I think the games have become a little bit more sort of, in inverted commas, boring. Not if you're an Arsenal fan, obviously. But they're also, again, they're showing that quality of stability, control, a clinical nature in front of goal. I think it's just really hard not to be impressed by the job that Mikel Arteta has done.
What do you think, Martin? Is there more to come still from Arsenal?
I think potentially there is. I think if you look at Declan Rice, you know, someone's got to play rhythm guitar, and you know, and just because you're the rhythm guitarist doesn't mean you're any less important. If you listen to All My Loving by the Beatles, you listen to John Lennon's rhythm guitar and All My Loving by the Beatles, it is absolutely astonishing. If you try and play as fast as that for about 3 minutes as he does, you know, honestly, put it on if you're listening to this at home after the podcast, obviously not now, don't go away from the podcast, whatever you do, because your recording machine will explode. I can promise you that we've got that capability. But if you listen to All My Lovin' and how fast John Lennon's rhythm guitar play, it doesn't mean that rhythm guitar is an unimportant thing that's going on. It's a real driving force, and that's what it is. You know, he's not the lead guitarist. You know, they're all up front. But what Declan Rice has brought to Arsenal is game-changing for them. He's such an elevation over what they had last season. He's such an upgrade, and that's why they paid. That's why they paid the money that they did. And you know, we all think Man City will win the league. I think most people think Man City will win the league, but Arsenal are top of the league now, and they've got a chance. And they've spent £200 million on players in the summer, and that should give you more of a chance than you had last season, without a shadow of a doubt. They should have more chance of holding Man City off this season than last season. And Rice will be one of the reasons for that.
And I think we've got to recognise that, you know, coaching's not about having like drawing up a grand plan and then implementing it. You know, it's about responding to what you see and adapting. And at the start of the season, Arteta was experimenting with having Partey and Rice together, and disrupted the Gabriel and Saliba partnership to try and get Ben White in the middle, because he was clearly thinking in sort of Pep-ish terms about getting, you know, everyone running into midfield at some point. And it wasn't really working. And he's just had the good sense to take note, reflect, tweak things and go back to the Saliba and Gabriel and refine what Rice is doing, bring Havertz on in the right way, and now they're flying. And that, you know, it's what a top manager does. It's continually refining and learning and not being dogmatic.
I think one other point I'd raise as well is, and I suppose you probably have to give Arteta most of the credit for this, is the maintenance of mood and morale. Because you look at the last two seasons, really, the end of the last two seasons for Arsenal, you'd have to say really were crushing disappointments. They're, you know, losing their grip on fourth place and Champions League qualification, and, you know, losing a title race that, you know, at one stage they seemed to be in control of. You know, hugely disappointing, deflating experiences for a squad to go through. But they've started both of the following seasons, in both cases, they've started brilliantly. And that's so hard to do, I think, you know, when you're coming off such a, you know, you feel like you've thrown it away and you've sort of got to start at the beginning again. So easy to kind of succumb to that sort of flatness, and they haven't done that. And I think you have to be really impressed by that as well.
I couldn't understand why he didn't take Saka off at half time.
No.
I mean, I find that mind-boggling.
He doesn't look like a player who wants to come off, though, does he?
No.
He said as much afterwards.
No, but you can't do that.
No,
of course. You know, you can't just go, oh, well, come off when you feel like it, mate. You know, I was amazed. I mean, the scoreline, if ever there was... I can understand some of the guys that have been out injured that you might think, right, they need to get minutes in their legs. They, you know, but Saka, at times this season, has looked as if he could do with a break. And I was just amazed that he didn't say, right, mate, you've won the game for us in 45 minutes. You know, take the rest of the night off, basically.
Well, Arsenal are through, as are Manchester City, who were confirmed as group winners with a 100% record after coming back from 2-0 down to win 3-2 against RB Leipzig. Celtic are out following their 2-0 defeat against Lazio. Any other business? Jude Bellingham doing more Jude Bellingham stuff.
This
kid.
What could you say? But that assist, if you haven't seen it already, have a look at that. Have a look at that assist and what it means with the game kind of already done anyway. But, you know, what that meant to him and the quality of it.
When you look at the records that Kane and Bellingham are, when you look at the names of the people that they'll overtake, you know, like Bellingham has now got, he's more prolific in certain, you know, scoring charts than Di Stefano was when he first arrived at Real Madrid. Harry Kane has now scored more goals than any other English player in the Bundesliga, and he's only played 12 matches. Now, so that includes Kevin Keegan, who won, you know, the European Footballer of the Year at Hamburg and didn't score as many goals in a season as Harry Kane has in 12 matches for Bayern Munich. I mean, it's astonishing stuff. Yeah. It's astonishing stuff.
Do we think either of Bellingham or Harry Kane might fancy turning their hand to refereeing when they end up with this? Probably
well,
not.
Jude can do anything.
It couldn't do any worse.
Okay, well, that's where we're going next, because it's been another bruising week for officials, not just in Europe, but in the Premier League as well, after yet more controversy in Fulham's 3-2 win over Wolves on Monday night. And one of the ideas being put forward is to fast-track former footballers as VARs, assistant VARs, referees. Martin Ziegler has written a story this week about a dozen Football League players who have put themselves forward to do just that. Martin, you wrote about this in a column earlier in the week as well. It's an idea that's been put forward for a few decades, never really come to fruition, and it's going to be complicated.
It's going to be very complicated, simply because we live in a time of zero trust, enormous suspicion over everything. So, to give an example, last week, Chris Kavanagh refereed at Manchester City versus Liverpool. The moment it became known that Chris Kavanagh was refereeing, there was a lot of pushback on social media. He's from Greater Manchester. How can he be given a Manchester City? He comes from Ashton-under-Lyme. It's 5 miles away from the Etihad Stadium. There is no record whatsoever that Chris Kavanagh supports either of the major Manchester clubs. The fact that he's refereed them multiple times would suggest this. And yet, just this sort of set of facts, you know, put together, means that he couldn't possibly be a fair arbiter of Manchester City versus Liverpool. So my only question about all of this is, so how are we going to get on with an ex-professional when a lot of ex-professionals have got 8 clubs, 9 clubs? So by the time you exclude all of those, and then you exclude every single club that could be influenced by the fact that a guy that used to play for Preston North End, now this could affect promotion in the Championship. We'll have a look at the Championship table. And if you know, every team that could possibly end up in the top six, right, he can't referee them because he used to play for Preston. Well, we are going to have to learn, or football generally is going to have to trust a little bit more in the integrity of the participants. And I'm not talking about, you know, Matt Letizia, you know, being VAR for Southampton. You're talking about fellas that have had a lot of clubs and stuff like that. The sort of EFL guys that have applied, one imagines, might be fellas who haven't made a huge amount of money out of the game. Journeyman professionals. Well, journeyman professionals tend to have multiple clubs.
Well, it's funny you should say that. The PFA, I'm writing a piece about this for the weekend, so right. I've done a little bit looking into it. And the PFA, in conjunction with the FA and PGMOL, ran a course in 2019, I think. Mm. And the most, I think only a handful of players took this offer up. And the most recognisable name was Chris Iwuluma. And he's a veteran of 18 clubs. So you have a point. You absolutely have a point.
So by the time you take all of those 18 clubs out of the equation...
Well, it couldn't work. It wouldn't work then.
And then you take all the clubs that could potentially be affected by one of those 18 clubs out of the equation.
Yeah.
I mean, is it Brecon City, basically? You know, that's about the only place... You know, I use as an example Marcus Bent, because I think Marcus Bent ended up with 14 clubs or whatever. And by the time you took all of the only league he could have refereed in is League Two. They don't even have VAR anyway. So It's that sort of, unless we are prepared to go, well, look, just because someone played seven games for Blackpool, you know, we don't make him a regular behind the goal and standing there in a big orange and white scarf. You know.
So, more broadly, are there merits in this, Johnny? Like, is there an untapped source of expertise here that can possibly be mined? What do you think about the idea and theory?
Without a doubt, they could see the potential. I mean, Martin's absolutely correct about the fact we need to actually just trust a bit more and not, you know, not kind of trying someone that you'd have to leave someone's playing career aside, clearly, in terms of partisanship. But in terms of what a footballer could bring, of course, you know, we're talking before coming on about the gap that you see all the time now between what happens on the pitch and what ex-professionals are saying in the studios. I mean, Owen Hargreaves was speechless last night about the various penalties in Europe this week. Just saying, I don't understand that. You know, the people making these decisions have not been near a football pitch. And we can't have this enormous gap between the experience of those who've been on the pitch and decisions that are being made. I think there's also clearly the respect that you'd hope that an ex-pro would get from other pros, and that might address behaviour a little bit. You'd hope they'd be more nuanced, or it would allow those referees to apply nuance to things like tackles and the force of a tackle, what's fair, what's not. And you can see the benefits. One of my questions about it is simply that, a bit like coaching, refereeing's become almost a lifelong profession. And I've interviewed a couple of refs or assistants over the years, and I find that they start younger and younger now. Mm. So Akil Housen, who I interviewed back in September, he did play when he was a kid, but realised he wasn't quite going to make it, and at 14 started refereeing. And you're getting people now who are coming through the system in their teens to quite a high level, because it's pretty difficult to get all the way to the top. You have to start early. So a bit like coaching, people are taking almost a decision, you know, before the point they'd have a playing career. So my only thing is, you know, how do you get these players up to the speed of somebody that's been refereeing for 20 years almost before they get to the Premier League?
Is it not purely about VAR though, Johnny?
I think it's both,
but it's a lot of it is about VAR, having someone sitting in the booth. So your referee would quite probably still be a guy like you're talking about, and it's more the fella looking at the cameras.
I think it's global though, isn't it?
And
I suppose. No, I mean VAR is the crisis.
That's an
that
immediate.
We're trying to solve. But I think the idea is for players to join the officials pool, basically. Mm.
As a general point, I think it's interesting because I sort of instinctively, you know, would view it in the same way as I would instinctively view coaching, which is, I don't think, you know, I think it's a slightly, to my mind, regressive is the wrong word, but I don't necessarily agree that you have to have played the game to be an outstanding coach. I mean, I think that's, you know, that's obviously well attested now, but it is interesting because I remember visiting, this was like 5 or 6 years ago now, I went to visit the Hennersweisweiler Academy in Germany, which is the big German coaching school, and this was at a time where, you know, really at its sort of, I mean, moment of kind of peak success, where it had sort of just churned out, you know, Julian Nagelsmann and also Thomas Tuchel and, you know, a number of outstanding coaches who had not played the game to a, you know, to a really serious level, or to, you know, had not had a kind of senior level career. And I spoke to the guy who was at the time the head of coaching development for the German FA at the Hennersweisweiler Academy, and said, well, you know, isn't this, you know, great that your, you know, approach is essentially that, you know, anyone can do it, and that, you know, you're churning out so many brilliant coaches who have never played the game professionally. And his response was actually very interesting, because he said, well, yeah, of course, you know, we will never, you know, we're really pleased about it. You know, it's brilliant that, you know, people like Julian Nagelsmann and Thomas Tuchel have got to the level that they've got to. But to be honest with you, that's not our approach at all. We're actually a little bit concerned that we're not producing top coaches who have been players. We'd like it if we were seeing more top players go through the Hennesweisweiler Academy, because we recognise that having been a player, it adds something. You know, it's something that you cannot, you know, it adds a measure of experience, knowledge. You know, you've been in those situations that you cannot, you know, you can never replicate. And it does just, it gives you an added something that, you know, surely must be helpful if you're a coach. And I suppose you could make the exact same point about refereeing. Instinctively, it feels a bit, you know, it feels a bit wrong that, you know, a sort of someone, an ex-footballer should sort of be able to, you know, jump the queue in inverted commas over, you know, a sort of career ref who, you know...
Because it takes, I think, on average 8 years to become fully qualified referee.
Yeah.
And some of the guys in the Premier League, it's taken them 15 years to reach that level. So, they've got a lot of experience in the bank, just
absolutely,
as a footballer has in
But
as
at the same time, when coaching badges, your B licence and all of this first came in, it was accepted that if you'd been a manager for 5 years or 10 years or 20 years or whatever, you didn't have to start, you know, getting your first licence or, you know, that 20-odd years of experience... That was your license. There was your license, boom, and that was your license. So, you know, it's got to count for something. It's got, because we're seeing decisions. It can't be right, as amusing as it may be. It cannot be right that every single weekend we can watch a match on television. Gary Neville is commenting, and something happens, and Gary says, "Well, that's never a penalty, or that's a penalty, or that." And then the complete opposite of what the man says happens. That's the decision, and it is happening every week. It's almost comical, and this is not a slight on Gary, because he's not wrong. Usually, you're sitting there in agreement with him, thinking, "Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's never a penalty in a million years." Next thing you know, someone goes over the monitor and gives a penalty. And you're looking at it thinking, really? Yeah. Because this fella played with England, played with Manchester, captain Manchester United. He can't always, you know, these guys can't always be wrong, because they're always sitting in the studio looking at each other, utterly mystified. They can't all not know what the hell is going on. They can't all not know the rules of the game. So a lot of what is happening now is completely foreign to people who played the game.
Who do you think would be attracted by this, Gregor, among players?
Lunatic.
I mean, that's exactly.
No, you're right.
Having had the grief of a playing career, do you want the grief of a refereeing career? But also, there's the economic thing. I mean,
absolutely, this is important, because if it's going to take, even if you are being fast tracked, you know, a lot of the guys we're talking about, they come from they still need to continue earning money as soon as they finish playing football. So if you're earning, I think you earn £120. Per game in the National League North and South, 180 per game in the National League, and it goes up a little bit in the Football League, and below that you can earn £50 a game or whatever. So it's not a vocation, it's not a job. So absolutely, I think the practicalities has made it, you know, of reaching a level where you actually earn a decent enough living, have made it impossible for footballers so far. There's only been one, Steve Bain, who played 450 odd games kind of, I think, through the 70s and 80s, and he did it in 6 years, and he's the quickest to get it to being a Football League referee. But he did it as well as working in a job. So absolutely, that's an important part, but it's a balance then, because you come back to the fast-tracking idea, and they're suddenly going to have to jump the queue over people who've done it for 10 years.
If you're fast-tracking into the VARC in particular, so you're addressing something that is without a doubt at a critical stage in its development, because you've got people that have supported it all throughout now saying, no, this is a bad idea, this doesn't work, you know, we should abandon this. So it's not just people that were sceptical about it at the start. Now, if you could get 20, 30, however many you'd need, ex-professionals that could sort that out, this is a billion-dollar industry. You know, this isn't £50 to sort of go out or go off to Gateshead and run the line or whatever. This is an industry that measures its turnover in hundreds of millions of pounds. So you could make it worth somebody's while as long as they were good enough. So you'd have to have quite an exhaustive process, and quite exhaustive vetting and however you wanted to do it. But if you ended up with a group of 30 guys that could actually make judgment calls on VAR that were useful, that were making a serious contribution to the game, and that we were all coming away from matches instead of going, what the hell have we just watched? We're coming away going, well, yeah, well, that made sense. That looked like a handball. That looked like a penalty. That looked like a sending off. That would be invaluable.
Mm. It's complicated, though, I think, isn't it? Because, I mean, that idea instinctively feels like it would be great. You know, we'd all love to see that. But I think...
You're interpreting rules that are a mess.
The referees, you know, the VARs currently, you know, for all their flaws, I think in most cases are applying the rules as they are written. And obviously, there'll be exceptions to that where they, you know, but essentially most of the time, could you then, you know, I think it would be very complicated to then sort of have, you know, a kind of famous ex-pro come in and sort of, you know, give their sort of more of a kind of gut feel interpretation. I was one, you know, it's tricky, isn't it? You get into all sorts of grey areas. And I also completely agree with Martin's original point that the whole discourse around refereeing and officiating is so convulsed by paranoia and distrust.
Yeah.
I just can't see it happening. I cannot see a world where you could have a famous ex-pro sit in the VAR booth and, you know, potentially, you know, contribute in this very match defining way, and that not, you know, just lead to, you know, outcry about, you know, he's only doing it
I mean, and the first thing someone would do would go through his Twitter account and they'd find a tweet 12 years ago when he said, oh, great that Manchester United got stuffed on, you know, and then it'd be, oh, why, he hates Manchester United. And we are, once again, I am falling into the dangerous situation, as exactly happened with VAR, where you think, because what will happen is they will make a lot of decisions that completely agree with mine, because that's what everyone thought with VAR. Everyone that was saying, oh, VAR will sort everything out, what they're thinking in the back of their mind is, and everyone will agree with me that was mighty. A penalty, and that was, you know, that was handball. Mm. They'll all agree with me. And what they're now furious about is that it turns out no one agrees with anybody, you know, half the time.
Yeah.
And it would be a similar sort of thing with this, because you'd think, we'll get a professional in there. So when I'm sitting at home and I look at that and I go, well, that's never a penalty in a million years, the fellow in the VAR booth will go, that's never a penalty in a million years. You're quite right, Martin. That's absolutely right. And we'll all go on and I'll be happy. But that's not how it works. That is just, it's not how it works. So, I just think those guys, I think their opinions got to count for something. Yeah. I know what you're saying, James. I know what everyone, I can see all the pitfalls.
You look at, I mentioned cricket again, so many examples of brilliant umpires who've come from playing, and they really add something, and they've got credibility. Yeah. They've been among the very finest. So many issues with this that we've touched on, but I suppose it's surely worth at least pushing it down the line and exploring. Seeing how many players want to do it. I mean, this will be the litmus test, won't it? If there's not really a big appetite for it among former players, then...
Well, there's a dozen so far. That's not that many out of quite a lot of recently retired and current players approaching the end of their career.
It's not bad. It shows that there must be a crisis of some kind if people are sticking up their hands and saying, well, I'd like to help, I think I could help sort this out. Because there was one initiative like this a few years ago and they didn't get a single person. Not a single person. Because Jimmy Hill was banging on about this 20, 30 years
ago. Did he qualify as a referee or something?
No, he was a qualified
referee. He did everything, didn't he?
He did everything. He qualified. Yeah. He was at a match for the BBC or ITV. He was at a match, Jimmy. And the linesman went, the referee went over, pulled a hamstring or whatever, and the linesman had to take over. And this was before fourth officials. And so the call went out. Is anyone in the ground a qualified referee? And Jimmy Hill ran the line for most of the second half.
Brilliant.
Came down, I'm a qualified referee, and boom, ran the line. Fantastic.
That's what we want to see, Gary Neville running the line.
I'd tell you what he would as well, whether he was qualified or not. He's talked to the players, wouldn't he? Absolutely.
Well, we'll see. And look, this isn't going away. There's going to be more, not less VAR, if reports are to be believed.
Free kicks and corners.
Yeah, free kicks, yellow cards.
I must admit, if you can, that works for me. If you apply one simple guideline, you've got to be out of seat in 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Can't delay the game for more than 30 seconds for a corner. Right, but if you can see straight away, one replay, no, it's come off that fella, you should be able to tell the referee, no, that's come off the other player. There was a match a couple of seasons ago, Burnley at West Ham, and West Ham at Burnley, sorry. And I'm driving along the car on a Saturday. I'm listening to it on the radio, and the radio commentator called in real time that a decision that was a Burnley corner was a West Ham goal kick. And he called it from sitting in, and we've all been in that press box at Turf Moor. You're not exactly near. You couldn't be further up the back of the stand. And he called in real time, naked eye, that's a mistake. The COCOMS guy said exactly the same. That's a West Ham goal kick. Anyway, gets given as a Burnley corner. I'm driving along. One of my lads is in the passenger seat. We're both West Ham fans. We've looked at each other going, they'll score from this, you watch. And with that, they scored. Now, VAR are going to look at whether there was any pushing or this or that going on in the penalty area when the corner came in. Is there a reason? You know. So why can't VAR, if it takes 15 seconds, just say to the referee, oh, by the way, that's a West Ham goal kick. And it's not because it's West Ham. I've seen it on two or three occasions where it's gone the wrong way. And you've just thought, well, actually, VAR should be able to tell the referee, because that's a goal-scoring opportunity. VAR should be able to tell the referee they've given the corner the wrong way. As long as you're not sitting there for 4 minutes waiting for the decision, if you can do it in 30 seconds or 15 seconds, 20 seconds, set a limit. But you've got to be able to see it in one take.
Mm.
Kind of comes back to my point from the other week, though, that I think we've opened Pandora's box. I'm not sure it'll ever be fully satisfactory, but it certainly isn't going away. Look, finally, Martin, you weren't here with us on Monday to react to the sad news that Terry Venables passed away at the age of 80 at the weekend. Yeah, he's someone you were close with. He's someone you've referenced very
many times on this podcast. I said that in the piece, actually, that I probably quote him as much as I do any manager, you know, still managing. Yeah.
So why is that? Tell us a little.
Because he thought about football in a different way. He was a genuinely. I think he had a genuine visionary way of looking at football, looking at certain issues in football. His mentor was Malcolm Allison. Malcolm Allison was the same. We were talking the other week when you were writing the piece about goalkeepers and how many goalkeepers were coming from converted midfield players now and things like that. And I was saying that Malcolm Allison, nearly 50 years ago, was talking about goalkeepers being coached to pass the ball correctly, to strike the ball correctly. So most of them don't even know how to properly strike a football. Don't know actually what part of the foot you should be kicking with and, you know, when you should be, you know, where and when you should be kicking it. And Malcolm would be delighted now to see what has happened with goalkeepers, because he was talking about this 50 years ago. And Malcolm was Terry's mentor. And Terry thought about football in a different way. And, you know, do you want to talk about the World Cup draw and things like that? Certain things he did with England, certain things he did as an international manager. And you see elements of Gareth Southgate's management. And, you know, I've been there at Gareth's press conference and heard his answer to a question and just thought, yeah, that's because he worked with Terry, and that's how Terry would have looked at it. You know, he was a very, very different guy.
So Euro 96 was the first tournament I covered. Scotland. I actually met Martin at that. You probably wouldn't remember.
No,
I
do.
I was a little Scottish reporter.
Yeah, you owe me a fiver.
Yeah, well, I probably did, because you let me in. A joke. You and Lee Clayton let me into the Sunday briefing, which was priceless for me. But I couldn't understand. I mean, I do understand it, obviously. I know what the stories were, but why did Terry... Why did the FA get rid of him at the end? I know it's another can of worms.
Yeah, there was the schism with Alan Sugar, yeah. And so it's the Hyatt Hotel in Birmingham, and in January, in the January before the tournament, and they sit down to talk about his contract, yeah. And Ian Stott, I hope I've got his first name right, of Oldham. Noel White of Liverpool. There was the international committee, and they were particularly against Terry. They may dispute that. I mean, Terry always thought Noel White in particular was against him. And they were talking about the contract, and it was said that they didn't want to give him a contract until England had played the tournament. Because in their words, you've never won a competitive game for us, which is a bit unfair because he hadn't played a competitive game. And the conversation ends with him saying, "I don't do auditions," and that's the end of it. But what he also said to them, which was absolutely true, was, "You know, the guy you're going to get to replace me, he hasn't won a competitive game for you either." And which was true, which was Glenn Hoddle, and so that was it. And he never thought they really. You got to remember how he gets the job. Jimmy Armfield goes round and asks the managers who should be England manager, and takes this big sort of vox pop, and it was Terry.
Because my big one real close encounter with Terry was the press conference at the end. I remember him sitting there with the Sundays, which was probably his last.
Yeah,
briefing as England manager, and
kind
of it was sort of sadness, because what a great team it had been, what a great adventure, and he knew he was leaving, and just from an outsider's perspective, I was thinking, what is this? Why is this guy?
No,
why is this guy leaving?
It was. I can remember the photo call with Glenn Hoddle, because Glenn Hoddle was appointed before the tournament, so they knew you know Glenn Hoddle was already in place. And Glenn asked if he could attend training and everything during Euro 96, and Terry said no. And Glenn couldn't understand why, and Terry's attitude was, "No, I can't have them looking at you over there trying to impress you for what they think you want, and then me over here, and that doesn't work. You come in at the end." But I can remember the photographers were taking their photo, you know, the two of them together, and one of them said, obviously to Glenn, "Can we have a smile from the England manager?" And so he went, "Not for much longer, you can't." Which was absolutely spot on. But it was a great tournament. We had, and that's what I wrote in the piece, that we had lunch, me and him, the day before we played Germany, and that sort of thing as well, that sort of level of access, you know.
Is this a false memory, but was Rio Ferdinand training with England?
He called up four young players to train with
That's
the England
right.
squad, and Rio was among them.
He was 16 at the time or something.
Yeah, Rio was among them. Sol Campbell was among them. You know, it was very shrewd, because he called up very young players. Wasn't scared of picking players that were older. Bought John Barnes. Everyone thought, oh, we'll ditch John Barnes. He didn't ditch John Barnes. He eventually, you know, time. But at first, John Barnes was part of that team. But young players that he brought in, I mean, Gary Neville was, I think he was a teenager.
Yeah.
When he brought him in.
Yeah.
In that summer tournament where they played Japan, Sweden and Brazil.
Played him centre-back, didn't he?
Gary Neville's tweet. after Terry died, going through all the different positions he played at Euro 96 because the system was so flexible.
So it blew his mind, the kind of tactical...
Yeah, that he played right-back and he played right-wing-back and he played right of back three and... right wing as well. Once we had the ball, he was meant to be the right winger. It was footballers, as we all look at it and think, oh, it's meant to be played like that. It's meant to be flexible. It's meant to be all of these things. He's a really smart guy.
Well, if you haven't read Martin's piece, I'd advise anyone to go and read it. It's a beautiful read about Terry Venables. Martin, Johnny, James, thank you very much. If you enjoyed the show, make sure you're subscribed, leave us a review, and we'll be back on Monday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.